podcast on that gospel. David Lohse will be leading our talk today. He's a senior pastor at Mount Olivet Lutheran Church in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He's the author of the Making Sense book series, including Making Sense of the Cross, Making Sense of the Christian Faith, Making Sense of Scripture, among a number of others. His most recent book is Why Don't My Grandchildren Go to Church and What Can I Do About It? David speaks widely in the United States and abroad on preaching, Christian faith in a postmodern world, biblical interpretation. We are glad to be able to work with him on this podcast. Our podcasts are curated from our online learning library at churchnext.tv, so you can learn more about us there. If you'd like to support us, please consider a $9 monthly subscription. That would give you access to all of our individual online classes. Your generosity helps us produce digital experiences that help shape disciples. The beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. That's the beginning of Mark's Gospel. The first verse of one of the most intriguing books of the Bible is a brilliant confession of faith and the beginning of our own story. The Gospel of Mark is worthy of study on many levels. Scholars generally agree that Mark's Gospel was the first Gospel written, and it was a source for Luke's and Matthew's Gospels. Rather than beginning with a genealogy or a birth story, Mark opens with a direct declaration. One that will order his gospel, set its tone of urgency and action. Mark's gospel is a fast-paced narrative with many unique characteristics, but the messianic secret is one of the most fascinating. Jesus is constantly saying, "Don't tell anyone who I am." He's constantly trying to keep his identity as the Messiah secret, which can be very confusing for readers, as Mark demonstrates Jesus as Messiah and God's kingdom as a whole are not what we would expect. They're constantly surprising. It's only when the full story is known that we can make sense of it. Today, David Lohse explains why we have Gospels at all, and then answers four important questions. Who was Mark? To whom was Mark writing? What are Mark's important themes? What are the most important ideas that he's getting at? And how should we read Mark? So first, David talks about why we have the Gospels, which is a question that might seem odd to us because we really emphasize the Gospels. We're so focused on the Gospels in our own day that the idea, what are they doing there, is not really one we necessarily think of asking. But the Gospels were relatively late additions to the Christian canon. Most of the early Christian writings were by Paul, and only about 70 Common Era were the Gospels formally composed and organized. David talks about how the culture changed in the first 50 years after Jesus' death and resurrection. As followers of Christ began to suspect that Jesus' return was not immediately imminent, the need for historical records and ordered testimonies of Jesus' life became more urgent.
Before we kind of get into Mark in particular, I want to talk a little bit about why we have Gospels at all, which might at first seem like an odd question because we're so used to having Gospels, we read from them all the time. But it's actually kind of a new genre, not only in Christian literature, but in world literature. And if you look at the earliest writings of the Christian community, they come from the Apostle Paul, who's writing letters to churches that he founded and then had to move on and continues his relationship with them by correspondence. And one of the things that's kind of interesting about Paul is that his letters are almost entirely devoid of any information about Jesus, about his life, about his ministry, about his teaching, miracles. There's next to nothing there. There's no biographical information. There's no stories of his birth. All Paul is interested in is Jesus' death and resurrection. And we think they came about for a couple of reasons. I'm going to list four briefly. The first is that, again, when you're reading Paul, the earliest Christian writer, you have a clear sense of Paul's own anticipation that Jesus will be coming back and coming back very quickly, very soon. And Paul's probably writing in the 50s, between 50 and 60, give or take a little bit, so about 20 years after the ministry, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And in Paul's ministry, there's a constant kind of expectation that Jesus will be coming back at any moment. So not only does he not have any interest in the historical Jesus, but he doesn't have time to research that data either because he's so consumed by proclaiming the gospel in the time that's allowed. The Gospels are written in the 70s and 80s, and Mark, probably the earliest, is written somewhere around or just after 70 AD, so another 20 years after Paul. And by this time, the church has recognized that Jesus hasn't come back yet or as quickly as people expected, and may not be coming back in the immediate future. And that's a huge change in the imagination and consciousness of the church. And so early Christian communities are now, they're recognizing that they're going to be here for the long haul. And for that reason, they begin to think a little bit more and more deeply about their origins and their story. So that's reason number one. Jesus didn't come back as quickly, and the Gospels are an attempt to make sense of Jesus' story in light of that. Second thing is that if you can imagine the Gospels being written about 40 years after Jesus' ministry, then it's probably not surprising that many of the eyewitnesses, many of the original disciples and apostles and people who knew Jesus firsthand are beginning to die. And if you think about the tremendous interest in the recollections of our own World War II veterans about 10 years ago, as we got to the 40th and then 50th anniversary of D-Day and the rest, there was this profound recognition that this generation, the greatest generation, was soon to pass. And so there are all kind of documentaries and oral histories. We wanted to capture their testimony. And something very similar is going on in the Christian community. As more and more of the original eyewitnesses die, there's this tremendous interest in capturing those recollections and preserving them. Third reason is that by this time, there are a lot of stories of Jesus circulating around, and the communities that are forming around this story need to sort them out. And so there's an interest in laying some order to them. In fact, when Luke starts his gospel, he'll say, You've no doubt heard many people try to offer an orderly account of Jesus' life. That's what I'm going to do too. And before Luke does it, Mark's doing the same. So he's taking different traditions, parables, miracle stories about Jesus, and crafting them, shaping them into an orderly story that will help his community. Fourth reason then stems from that is that this is the time in the 70s and 80s of major upheaval in the early Christian communities. And that's particularly true of Mark, because the world is changing, and particularly the world of Judaism is changing as the destruction of the temple. Israel's caught up in about an eight-year war with the Romans, and at the culmination of that war, the Jerusalem temple is destroyed. And that not only affects Jews of the first century, it affects Christians, most of whom themselves are Jews or were connected to the Jewish church. And so in light of this massive upheaval, there are tons of questions about is this the end of the world, and does this mean that Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, or does this free us to witness to the whole world, or what's going on? And so each of the Gospels is written to a particular time and place to address some of those questions.
We don't actually know who Mark was. In fact, David argues that his anonymity was perhaps deliberate, so that our focus as readers would be on Jesus, not on the storyteller. Mark is a man of mystery. However, David talks about what we can tell about Mark's purposes and accomplishments in composing this account of Jesus' life, which is interpretive rather than a reproduction of events.
The striking element of Mark is that he really does invent a new genre of literature called a gospel. And I want to focus just for a second on the very first verse of the Gospel of John. In some ways, it serves as a title. There is no title of this book originally. We call it the Gospel of Mark. It just starts off. But it's also more than a title, as it begins to open up to us the purpose of Mark's writing. So Mark begins this way: the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. That's it. No genealogy is in Matthew, no hymn to the word is in John, no story of angels and shepherds and the Virgin Mary is in Luke. Just this one brief tidbit, the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And what's interesting about that statement is two things. One, Mark tips us off as the reader to who Jesus is from the very beginning. Jesus, the Christ, the Messiah, who is also the Son of God. And as we get further into the study and look at Mark's gospel, we'll recognize that Jesus is regularly at pains to kind of conceal his identity. But we, the reader, know who he is right from the beginning. The second thing, though, is that Mark uses this word good news or gospel in an entirely new way. It's a word that's already common to the Christian tradition. Paul talks about the proclamation of the gospel all the time, but every time he does, he means an announcement. Mark, however, talks about gospel, good news, as a story. And that's an entirely new development, that Mark is, in a sense, inviting us to imagine that, the person of Jesus, the revelation of what God is up to in and through his life, death, and resurrection, can't be contained to just faith statements anymore. That there's a way that it's bound up in a larger story. And so Mark invites us from the beginning to read this story of Jesus from beginning to end, and to and his promise is that he'll disclose to us who Jesus is and what God is up to through this story, through this narrative. And it sets a new pattern for Christian preachers and evangelists from then on. Now, Mark himself is unknown. So the answer to the original question, who is Mark, is very short. We have no idea. You know, there's been all kinds of speculation, but truth be told, when we call Mark, Mark, we do that out of convenience. We have no idea who this person was other than a Jewish Christian. The tradition of calling this Mark dates to the middle of the second century. The name comes from the story in Acts, John Mark, who was a companion of Peter. And the tradition always wondered if Mark was Peter's scribe, Peter's companion, and that in some ways the Gospel of Mark is a memoir of Peter. But to be honest, all of that is speculation and probably not accurate. It's a good story, but probably not a true one. Mark, we don't know, and I actually think that's deliberate. That Mark, in the story, did not want us to focus on who he was or where he was coming from. Instead, he wanted us to fasten our eyes and pay attention entirely to Jesus, the character of the story, and the Savior of the world. I think what Mark is doing is he's writing a religious biography, and at the same time, he's making a confession of faith. He's offering a testimony. And so when we read Mark, I think what is helpful for us to imagine is that what we're doing is reading a reinterpretation of Jesus rather than a reproduction. Mark's interest, as with the other evangelists, is not in building a historical case of who Jesus was the way modern historians would do that. In fact, no first century historian operates that way. The purpose of history was always to instruct and to inspire. The first century historians, and certainly Mark included, were trying to reintroduce or reinterpret Jesus. People had all kinds of stories, but these stories needed to be applied to their own day and age. And so while these stories, Mark's included, are rooted in the actual experiences of persons, there's tremendous liberty. And if you ever lay one story of Jesus in Mark or Luke beside another in Matthew or John, you'll be struck by the similarity to a degree, but probably more struck by the dissimilarity and the tremendous differences, sometimes nuanced, sometimes very pronounced. Sometimes the way I think about it is, if you have ever been in a sculpture garden and you stand at four different points around a sculpture, that depending on the play of the light and the angle you're looking at, you see more of that sculpture than you ever could by looking at it straight on. Or if you've seen an artist who's a photographer who's taken the same photo at different times during the day or painted the same scene over the years, there's an added richness to the subject matter. And the church has kind of made the same decision that although the Gospels are different, we're introduced to a truer picture of Jesus by holding the four together. So are these the memories of Peter? History suggests not. But there's no reason not to enjoy that tradition or allow that tradition to give the sense that all of the Gospels are rooted in people's actual experiences of Jesus, the one we confess as Messiah.
So if we don't know who Mark was, to whom was Mark writing? Mark's audience's identity, as David will discuss, is less important than the fact that these people were living under duress, perhaps from persecution by the Romans, perhaps by the fall of the temple in Jerusalem, perhaps by increasing doubt or by loss of members in the community. Mark is trying to communicate that, like the disciples, we all fail. We all suffer disappointments and loss. The important truth to remember is that Jesus remains faithful.
All right, so second question that I will totally bomb at, because, again, we don't know. We don't really know who Mark's audience was. There's been a lot of speculation through the years. For a while, it was quite popular to think that Mark was writing to a group of predominantly Gentile Christians living in and about Rome. And there's good reason to sort of be sympathetic to that point of view. Two reasons. One, Mark writes in Greek, which was the language of educated Gentiles and Jews, for that matter, and the language common to the larger territories. And so he's not writing in an Aramaic, for instance. If he were writing to a Jewish congregation in Palestine, he probably would have written in Aramaic, which is what everyone was speaking, but he writes in Greek. Secondly, Mark's regularly explaining Jewish customs. And again, if he was writing to a very Jewish audience in Jerusalem or Palestine, they would have gotten that. So that was kind of initial thought. More recently, scholars are thinking that the community might have been in the outskirts of Galilee or even Syria, and probably were a little more even both Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians, and not dominated by one group or the other. Because Mark explains some things, but other things he assumes the reader already knows. And it could be that a Jewish community that was living at a distance from Jerusalem would have been somewhat familiar with customs, but not entirely. But in the end, you know, we don't know. What's probably more important, though, than precisely who it was what their circumstances were. And it's, again, there are a couple of theories. It used to be quite popular to think that this was a group of Christians who were undergoing persecution. And again, if you imagine this a community in Rome, this gospel is written not long after the time Peter is put to death and Paul is executed. It might also be that this community is more caught up in the general strife and struggle of what happens after the fall of the Jerusalem temple. Because again, this is a cataclysmic event. I don't mean to make light of either end of this comparison, but it's like the 9/11 for that generation of Jews and Christians. There's a sense that it changes everything, and everybody knows where they were, what's going on when they heard the word that the temple in Jerusalem falls. So whether they're Christians in Rome experiencing persecution, or as more people think now, are Christians in Galilee or Syria who are utterly caught up in the turmoil of identity crisis and confusion and wondering if this is the end of the world. It's a time of tremendous stress and duress, and very likely a number of Mark's community had fallen away from the faith at one time or another, that because of the pressures, both from perhaps other Jewish communities, perhaps Roman persecution, perhaps just from the confusion of the time, a lot of people have lost faith, and some may now be coming back. And so I think where that gets interesting to kind of have the rubber hit the road is in one of the distinct features of Mark, and that's his characterization of the disciples. Mark is, on the whole, pretty hard on the disciples. He does not flatter them at any point in the story. There's a way in which if you read Mark through quickly and pay attention just to the fidelity and the character of the disciples, you'll come away kind of wondering, like, how in the world did these guys get a church started? I mean, they are in some ways the keystone cops of the ancient Christian world. Jesus predicts his death three different times, and each time their response is more or less, they don't get it at all. And this utter disappointment Jesus must have felt and the utter failure of the disciples is present throughout the gospel, but keenly present right here. And the question then becomes, why? Now I'll go back a moment to what I said earlier about we don't know who they are. Maybe that doesn't matter. We do have some sense of their circumstances. They are themselves under duress. They themselves are failing and feeling at times faithless. They themselves have suffered loss as Christians have deserted their faith and gone back to their old lives. And now these Christians are beginning to trickle in, or the question arises, what do we do with the people who have come back? Or how do we interact with people who used to be part of our company and aren't? Or what do we do when we've let Jesus down under persecution or distress? And the answer again and again from Mark is, hey, can you look for a moment at the group we came from? fidelity has never been the requirement. Perfect fidelity has never been the requirement to be a disciple of Jesus. Jesus is faithful, even we are not. And if Peter who denies, Peter, James, and John who fall asleep, and if the whole company of disciples who desert Jesus are also the ones who share the sacred meal and who were commissioned and sent to proclaim the word, then we can too. So who is Mark writing to? A group of Christians who are caught up in the culture and who are wondering, what does it mean to be a disciple? And who sometimes are faithful and sometimes faithless. Mark's writing to a group that's not unlike a lot of Christians I know today.
Mark's gospel can be summarized in the following confession of faith. Jesus is God's Son, the Messiah, the one called to proclaim and inaugurate God's coming kingdom, none of which will look anything like we would ever expect. Next, David talks about five important ideas, five major themes in Mark's gospel.
Let me offer a summary statement, kind of Mark in a nutshell. Here's what I would say. Mark wants to confess that Jesus is God's Son, the Messiah, the one called to proclaim and inaugurate God's coming kingdom. And none of that looks like anything you and I would ever expect. So that's kind of Mark, and both of those halves are true. It's important to see that Mark confesses from the very first verse all the way through that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. Jesus' activity is to proclaim the kingdom, and not only to proclaim it, but to inaugurate it in word and deed. But the kingdom, as the kingdom takes shape, it is what nobody would expect then or now. So with that in mind, let me kind of name a couple of sub-themes or the way that larger summary or core confession comes to expression. First, Mark wants to confess that God is set against anything that would rob the children of God of life. And so when God's Messiah, Jesus, comes, he is constantly set against illness and possession and calamity and disease and hunger, that his whole ministry, in a sense, is to sort of beat back all those forces that oppress humankind. That brings up a second theme, which is what's sometimes called the messianic secret. And a lot of people who read the gospel, from scholars and preachers down to everyday Christians, wonder again and again, like, why does Jesus keep telling people, don't tell anyone about me? It seems like so counterintuitive and counterproductive. And we can't imagine our pastor ever preaching from the pulpit, now this is who Jesus is, don't tell anyone. Like, it's the exact opposite. And I think what we begin to get is this picture of a kingdom and a Messiah that is so different from what we'd expect that there's no way we would get it. Because as we'll see in Mark's gospel, the kingdom Jesus announces, the Messiah he emerges as, is not only not what we'd expect, but we don't even know where to look for it. And finally, it's revealed only in and through the cross. And there's a way in which Mark says, look, come along for the story, because you're not going to believe it, and you're not going to really understand it till you get at the end. All right, third little theme. Jesus comes teaching in parables. Now, there isn't in Mark the same number of parables as we get in Matthew and Luke. And some of our favorite parables, the Good Samaritan or the Prodigal Son, are entirely missing. But there are just a couple. They're all about the kingdom, and they reveal something of the kingdom. Jesus tells the story about a guy who goes out to sow seed. And then with the disciples explains what that parable means, and the force of that part of the story is on the soil. And it ends up being a sort of admonition to be good soil. In fact, we have hymns and sometimes sing songs of that nature. But if you go back and read the parable and not get too tilted in your interpretation by where it ends up, there's this other really interesting feature, and that is that this sower, the sowers are like a really bad farmer. Because seed is expensive and valuable. It's a commodity. And this dude throws it everywhere. He throws it on paths that people walk on. He throws it on shallow soil. He throws it places where he knows birds are going to get it. And he throws some on good soil. And so the other way to think about this parable is, who in their right mind would waste seed like that? And what Jesus is saying, God would. this kingdom is going to come everywhere, not just where you expect a good soil, but on rocky, on shallow, and places where the birds are going to get it or the sun is going to scorch it. This kingdom is going to be for everyone everywhere. The other theme in Mark that's worth paying attention to is that he is regularly running up against the religious authorities, and there's this kind of building tension. And the question becomes why? And the easy answer is, well, the Pharisees didn't get it. They rejected the Messiah. The deeper answer is that because Jesus' kingdom is so different and so unexpected, that most of us, if we're honest, are not going to see it coming and be a little troubled when it begins to take shape. And so this theme of opposition is everyone who thinks they know who God is like and where God ought to show up is going to be disappointed and maybe offended. A friend of mine once said, anytime you draw a line between who's in and who's out of the kingdom of God, you can pretty well expect Jesus to be on the other side of that line. Last theme, Jesus' identity finally and fully is revealed on the cross, the last place you'd ever expect God to be. And we have seven last words of Jesus. In Mark, we only get one of those words, and it's the cry of despair. My God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus loses everything. Jesus, frankly, in Mark's passion, is a loser. One who's lost it all, friends, family, fortune, fame, and dies lonely as a criminal with no one to witness his passing except the one who executed him, the Roman centurion. But in that moment of darkness and desperation, the centurion echoes Mark's introduction and says, truly this man was the Son of God. Which again is a word to Mark's community. When you think all hope is lost, that's where God will surprise you by showing up not where we expect God to be, but where we need God to be.
So, with all this, how best to approach Mark's gospel? David winds up his talk with four important things to remember and do when we're reading the gospel, how to approach it in ways that will help us get the most out of our reading.
How do we read Mark from start to finish? Which sounds like either obvious, except we never do that with biblical books. We always read little snippets, usually on Sunday morning, and sometimes rearranged over the course of weeks so that we really have no idea of what Mark's actual story is like. But the reason that's important is because Mark, again, as we mentioned earlier, is doing a new thing. He's preaching the faith through a story. And again, in Paul, you get sermons, and you get letters, and you get messages. Mark's the first one to say, you know, it's too big for that. You want to know Jesus, you got to know his story. And so sit down, really, take an hour and read from start to finish, and you'll be amazed at the number of themes that pop up, some of the themes we talked about, and other things that will surprise you. Second thing as you're reading is pay attention to the urgency of Mark's gospel. Some people compare Mark or describe Mark in relation to the other three, that Mark is the evening news version of the gospel story. It's not the drama. It's not the miniseries. It's the evening news. It's blow by blow, account by account. It moves very quickly. And there's this word that pops up in Mark immediately. Immediately he left. Immediately he went up and got. Immediately he took them and said. That word is used 10 times in the rest of the New Testament and over 40 times in Mark's gospel. Mark liked that word because a couple reasons. He wants to keep the pace of the story moving, but more than that, Mark has a sense of urgency that God's kingdom isn't just coming in general. It's coming in Jesus before your very eyes. And if you're not watching carefully, you might miss it. It's coming now. It's coming immediately. And so as you read the story, allow Mark's urgency, his fervor, almost his, there's something kind of frantic about Mark because the good news is so important and so easy to miss that he really wants you to pay attention. Third way to read Mark is to think a little bit about history or timing. There are a couple places where Jesus says something kind of interesting. He says the time is fulfilled. And the first time, as we mentioned earlier, is the very beginning of the gospel when he starts his preaching ministry. John the Baptist is sent to prison and then to death. And Jesus says, the time is fulfilled, the kingdom has come. And the rest of the story of Mark, after that ominous introduction, right, Jesus' ministry starts as John is imprisoned. The rest of the story of Mark is kind of an unfolding of what that kingdom looks like. All right, one last way to read Mark, and that is to be open to surprise. We've already said that the kingdom doesn't look like the kingdom we imagine. The Messiah doesn't look like the Messiah. In some ways, Jesus preaches the anti-kingdom and is the anti-king, coming to take care of people instead of receive their service, coming to tend their need instead of receive their honor, and finally dies on as a criminal. So we need to kind of keep being willing to suspend our expectations or to have those expectations surprised. We also need to be willing to be surprised by the way the story ends. Mark, again, is the earliest of the Gospels, and so this is the earliest account of the resurrection. So they went out from the tomb and fled, for terror and amazement had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone because they were so afraid. Now, odds are that's the way Mark's Gospel ends. If you're reading in your Bible, you'll see that there are two more endings that are, you know, we don't have any original copies of the Bible. Our oldest complete versions come from the Middle Ages. Fragments of the Bible come from the second century. So what scholars have done is kind of pieced together the Bible from all kinds of fragments, and we're pretty confident Mark ends here at verse 8. What's with the other endings? Well, there are two things that are kind of disturbing about this ending. One is it's the only resurrection account where, guess what? No Jesus. Jesus doesn't show up. So that's a little problematic. And second, these women who are the disciples hear the proclamation, and they don't just get any proclamation. They get the classic announcement of good news. Do not be afraid. Everywhere in the Bible, when someone starts by saying, do not be afraid, you know good news is coming, right? If they start, woe unto you, you know bad news is coming, but do not be afraid, good news. So they get the classic announcement of good news, and then what? They fail. They say nothing to anyone and flee in terror and are mute. It's a catastrophe. So imagine that you're a monk, and your job is to copy the Gospel of Mark, and you're given this Gospel, and it's your first assignment, and you're writing away, and you get to the end, and there's no Jesus, and the women fail, and you're horrified. And then you have this good idea. Hey, I can fix that. And so what we think are these two other endings are written by well-intentioned monks. So why this ending then? Why this odd, unusual, unsettling ending? Well, I think Mark does this intentionally. I think that when we see the story of Mark's story of Jesus' death, what happens? The chief disciples fall asleep. The head disciple denies. The rest of the disciples desert. The women that come to the tomb leave in silence. It's an utter failure. But there's one other person who knows what's going on. One other person who was told at the very beginning who this is and who has been watching and listening all the way along. When you go back to Mark 1:1, he tells us, the reader, we're left. Mark sets up a failure to put the burden and responsibility of proclamation on our shoulders. So that as you're reading this, if you take the time to read straight through, when you get at the end, your reaction ought to be kind of like that monk. Oh my goodness, this can't happen. But instead of writing a new ending, you become the ending. You go and tell.
That is the end of David's talk for today. Thank you for tuning in. If you'd like to learn more of David's ideas, look at his Making Sense series and his most recent book, Why Don't My Grandchildren Go to Church and What Can I Do About It? David has also done 3 classes for Church Next besides this one. He did Making Sense of the Cross, parts 1, 2, and 3. I highly recommend that series for Lent. It's a terrific series. You might also check out our other introductory gospel classes, Gospel of John, Gospel of Luke, and the Gospel of Matthew. All of these are available on podcast as well as in class form. Thank you for tuning in. If you'd like to learn more about us, please go to churchnext.tv. We'll close with the following prayer. May God bless us all and keep us. May God make God's face shine upon us and be gracious unto us. May God lift up God's countenance upon us and give us peace, today and forevermore. Amen.